some people can't seem to get into their heads. You can be a Westerner and a Muslim. You can be somebody who's integrated and a Muslim. To suggest the whole of London, 600 miles squared, is a no-go area is simply not true. People are right to be angry. You can't wake up and watch those images and not either cry and weep or be angry. And, you know, we got to call out our politicians, you know, but the idea that we have, a more stringent test on Labour when we're in opposition for the last 14 years than we do in the party of government, I think is a bit naive and a bit wrong.
Welcome to the Big Picture Podcast. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and today we sit down with London Mayor Sadiq Khan. Khan made history when he took over the high-profile position in 2016, making him one of the most influential Muslim politicians in Britain and arguably the Western world. He's now looking to break ground again and become the first London mayor to secure a third term if he defeats his conservative rival Susan Hall in May. The Tooting-born lawyer stems from humble beginnings, the son of an immigrant bus driver, but has become a political insider in the Labour establishment, winning both praise and condemnation. His supporters say he's transformed the city, embracing its diversity and its Europeanness in a time of Brexit, while his detractors accuse him of everything from Islamizing the city and making it unsafe for British Jews to turning against his Muslim roots altogether. But he's attempted to walk a pragmatic line in a winter of anger, when mass rallies gripped London, amid calls for a ceasefire in Gaza and an end to the UK's support for Israel's government. He's now attempting to secure the city's large British Muslim vote once again, at a time when many are vowing to punish Labour at the polls for its failure to be a critical voice in Parliament and for his leader Sir Keir Starmer's pro-Israel statements. So does he think he can convince them otherwise? Mayor Sadiq Khan, welcome to The Big Picture. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's great to finally be asked to be on. So thank you for finally having me on.
Thank you. I mean, we're glad to have you. In the middle of this campaign, in the middle of Ramadan, how's the fasting been going? How's it treating you?
Well, alhamdulillah, we're recording this as we enter the last 10 days. Really important last 10 days. But it's been, I love Ramadan. I love campaigning. But the two together are quite challenging. And so I always tell people who are new to my team, can I apologize in advance for the next month? I'm very miserable when I'm deprived of caffeine.
Yeah.
Sleep and food. I love campaigning, so that trying to do both is difficult. But alhamdulillah, I can't complain. It's been a good Ramadan for me.
This is a bit of a personal question. How's your breath at this moment in time?
Yeah. So for those who are watching this who don't understand what we're talking about, so there's a lovely hadith, the saying of the Prophet, peace be upon him, saying actually your breath in Ramadan obviously doesn't smell lovely for the humans, no. But don't worry about that. There are blessings in relation to,
yeah.
So I'm chillaxed about that and stuff. The problem is not so much my breath, but it's I talk a lot because of my job, and it's the lack of moisture in my mouth.
Yeah.
And so, as it is, I speak fast, and I'm accused of mumbling in Ramadan. I think more so. But there are people who during the month of Ramadan are still performing surgery. Are still, cleaning out, stations, who are
playing sports,
driving buses and stuff, right? We've got to carry on, do what we do. And that's the whole point of the fasting, right? Because it's the sacrifice you're making whilst carrying on as normal. Mm-hmm. What, I think is not sensible is to, sleep for the entire day, because, that's the easy way for the fast to pass. And so I do try and be productive. Hopefully, people don't think I'm less productive during the month of Ramadan, but it is challenging. I mean, I miss two things. One is the caffeine, frankly speaking. Yeah. And two is the sleep. But, alhamdulillah.
We get through, alhamdulillah. I mean, the good thing is that both of us are fasting, so I think we're on the same energy level at this point.
Well, the worst thing is I often do debates or, maybe doing media stuff, and they'll put a glass of water there, right?
Yeah.
So I said, don't put water there, because human, the memory muscle is you drink water I said, no, because it can happen. So fortunately, because we're both fasting, no danger of any water being here.
Nothing. Although I feel really bad that I haven't offered any of you guys drinks, and I think my mother would be terrified right now. And my manners, but we're here and we're talking and we're getting along. How's the campaign going? This is your third time. It will be a historic third term in office. Why do you want the job again?
Well, this has been the toughest campaign so far, and we still were recording this with 33 days still to go. So there's still a long time to go in the campaign. And before I decided to run, I spoke to other people who'd run for a third time in this country, and overseas. And third elections are very hard because you've got to, you know, but by the nature of the job, over a period of time, there will be some people who, you know, will be displeased. That's just the nature of any job. But what excited me about running this time was we have an opportunity this year. The phrase I use is a moment of maximum opportunity. We've got the chance of having, you know, a Labour mayor working with a Labour government. And why do I say that? I've been mayor for 8 years, and throughout the 8 years, we've had a Conservative government. I've lost count of how many prime ministers I've had. It's like David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson. And so it's been really hard. So you've got an anti-London, chaotic government, and we've achieved a huge amount, notwithstanding that. You know, we've now, for the first time in the history of our city, give every child that goes to a primary school free meal. We've frozen fares 5 of the last 8 years. We're building record numbers of council homes, affordable homes. We are, you know, increased policing from City Hall, opened youth clubs and so forth. That's despite the government. Imagine what we could do with a mayor and a government on the same side. And that's why I'm so excited.
Mm. And 8 years is a long time to be in any role. But to be in a role as influential as this one, how do you think you have shaped the city in that time?
Well, when I look back at, you know, when I first became mayor in 2016, you know, it's just before the referendum, when, you know, our country voted to leave the European Union, with the trauma of Brexit. In 2017, we had 4 terrorist attacks on our city. We had the awful fire in Grenfell Tower, 72 people perished. We had the pandemic. We've had Putin's invasion of Ukraine. We've had the cost of living crisis. We've had the awful Liz Truss Conservative budgets. It's been really tough. The joke when people meet me is the only thing I've not had is a plague of locusts, sort of Pharaoh-esque. But I think despite that, I'm really proud of the progress we've made. So without, you know, the government being supportive, you know, for the first time in the history of our great city, for the first time ever, every child that goes to a state school now receives a free school meal. That's something I'm really proud of. For the first time in the history of public transport in London, in 5 of the last eight years, we've frozen fares. We've opened a new line, the Elizabeth line. We've brought in the Hopper fare, those who can use unlimited bus in the course of an hour. Council housing, which is affordable, you know, the highest number since the 1970s. The most homes completed any time since the 1930s. We're providing young people with mentors. Why is that important? Because I was blessed. I had big brothers who were a mentor to me. Many young Londoners haven't got a mentor. We're providing that. We're providing funding for youth clubs and youth workers. 500,000 young people have positive things to do because of our funding. And importantly, I've stood up for our values. That means standing up to Trump. That means, you know, recognizing, in my view, that the importance of our diversity, which is a strength, not a weakness. But, you know, it's been tough, but it's been incredibly enjoyable. There's a phrase I've got, which is, you know, 2 words, London promise. The London promise is very simple. It's you work hard, you get a helping hand, and you can achieve anything. For too long, Londoners haven't had the helping hand. And I've sought over the last 8 years to be that helping hand. But just imagine how much more that help would be if we had a Labour government and a Labour mayor. You know, what I've said over the last week, in the last 8 years, I've been rowing against the tide of a Conservative government. There's a possibility this year, if people vote the right way, for the next 4 years to have the winds of a Labour government at my backs. And that's what's exciting.
What difference do you think that will make to the way that you want to run the city?
Yeah. So look, I'm not claiming, by the way, that, you know, if we have a Labour mayor and Labour government, they're going to write me a blank check. No. But the point is, there wouldn't be constant, you know, obstructionists in my way. They wouldn't always be putting obstacles in my way. I'd be able to pick up the phone. I'd be able to explain why we need stuff, whether it's longer term budgets, whether it's more investment. And the good news is, by talking with the Labour Party nationally, they've already agreed to do a number of things that we think are important. So they've agreed to work with me. So we'll have tens of thousands of new council homes over the next few years. The Labour government's promise is 1.5 million homes in their first term. Many of those are going to come to London. I was with the Shadow Home Secretary last week, and she's agreed to fund 1,300 additional police and community support officers. And I'll be meeting other members of the Shadow Cabinet over the next six weeks to announce further policies. That shows the difference. If you're on the same team, you can make. And my frustration is actually a lot of the things we want to do shouldn't be about party politics. Surely everyone wants to invest in young people. Everyone wants to reduce crime. Everyone wants to make sure we address the housing crisis. But unfortunately, over the last 8 years, the government's been very antagonistic towards me because I'm, you know, not from their tribe. And over the last 14 years, I think this has been a really chaotic, divisive government.
Is there anything that you regret not being able to achieve in your time?
All of my regrets stem from, you know, my inability to persuade the government to be more supportive. Look, all of us have regrets. There's not a day I've gone to bed and not had regrets. But the big regrets is what I mean. The big regrets are because of, you know, lack of government support in relation to housing or policing or youth clubs or in relation to standing up for our values. And I reflect, could I have done more to persuade them to do things differently? But listen, there's not. I'll go to bed tonight and there'll be mistakes I made today. I think anybody who thinks they're a perfect professional, whether it's a journalist or a politician, is fooling themselves. And, you know, of course, I look back on things and I think, well, I could have done that differently or that differently. And the key thing is to learn. So each day you have to have the humility to realise what you do differently tomorrow. And, you know, that's how I try and live my life. Whether when I was a lawyer, I did the same thing when I was 11 years a lawyer. Whether I was when I was a parliamentarian, you know, I had the pleasure of being in the cabinet. Or whether it's now, I think you should always have the humility to think, you know what, how can I learn from that? What can I do better tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. And what do you hope to do better in the next couple of years if you do
win? Yeah, the really exciting thing is actually not always worrying about what the government's going to do. That looking over your shoulder because they're going to, you know, brief the newspapers or, you know, withhold money. I'll give you an example. During the pandemic, you know, the reality is people followed the advice and stayed at home, right? Now, we in the transport sector, Transport for London, rely upon passengers to pay their fares, and that's what gives us the money to provide services. And people stayed at home, so we had no money coming in. So we had to go to the government to ask for support, and they attached all these draconian conditions to the money they gave us to keep public transport running. And those conditions were awful for London. In the future, I'm hoping, because there'd be a government that wants us to succeed, they won't lay these elephant traps or these conditions, which benefits nobody in London. It's just plain party politics. And, you know, I think the public is fed up of, you know, politicians posturing plain politics, capital P. I want politicians just to provide decent services, look after their well-being, to enable them to fulfill their potential. And I'm hoping, you know, that this year, you know, as I said, a moment of maximum opportunity, people will take advantage of that, you know, give me their vote, give the Labour Party their votes in the general elections, and they will see the difference a Labour government and a mayor working together can make. You know, in the last 24 years, there's only been one four-year period, where there's been a Labour government and a Labour mayor. During that 1 4-year period, we won the Olympics, we secured Crossrail, and in 1 year alone, 8,000 council homes. So that's just, you know, one. Imagine what we could do in the next 4 years.
The Labour's taking credit for the Olympic wins.
We won the Olympics, yeah, in 2005. Yeah. The bid that went to the IOC was yeah, it was a Labour mayor working with the Labour government. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you want to bring the Olympics back?
2040. Watch this space.
All right, good. Now, you've had your fair share of criticism. Of course, everybody has. Some of it has particularly honed in on your identity as a Muslim in a city with a large Muslim community. And, I mean, recently, just in the last couple of weeks, Lee Anderson, the former deputy chair of the Conservative Party, said that you were under the control of Islamists. You know, you have your opponent, Susan Hall, who dismissed your kind of complaints of Islamophobia, saying that they were, quote unquote, hurty words. How do you fare with this kind of criticism, especially when it targets your identity?
Look, my starting point is, I think all of us have multiple identities. There's no one thing that defines me. So I'm a proud Londoner, born and raised in this city. I'm British. I'm of Pakistani origin, of Asian heritage, of Islamic faith. I'm a father. I'm a husband. So some people can't seem to get into their heads. You can be a Westerner and a Muslim. You can be somebody who's integrated and a Muslim. And what you see are examples of, you know, not just Islamophobic tropes, lazy untruths, sweeping generalizations, but clear examples of Islamophobia, anti-Muslim hatred, and racism. And it's really important it's called out for what it is. There should be no hierarchy when it comes to racism. The comments that the former deputy chairman of the Conservative Party made are clearly, according to any independent experts, Islamophobic and anti-Muslim and racist. What upsets me more than those words is, one, the British Prime Minister and his cabinet refused to call them out for as Islamophobic or racist or anti-Muslim. Two, the impact that has, forget me, you know, I don't want any special treatment, don't feel sorry for me. What impact does it have on a young person thinking about a career in politics, thinking about joining a mainstream political party, or thinking about this country giving them a sense of belonging and pride when senior people can say things like this? I mean, just think about the words you attributed. You said that Susan Hall, my Conservative opponent, said, so my conservative opponent wants to be mayor of this great city, the most diverse city in the world. We have Muslim people here, Jewish people here, Christian people here, Hindus here, Sikhs here, those who are members of an organized faith and aren't. And what words did she use? What are the words you just said she used?
The quote is hurty words.
She's saying hurty words. Mm. Would anybody say the phrase hurty words when somebody says something that was anti-Semitic or sexist? But you can say hurty words because these words are Islamophobic, anti-Muslim and racist. She aspires to be mayor of this great city. And, you know, that's a problem for me as a Londoner, because I don't want somebody like that being the mayor of this great city. And let me be frank, you know, there's been some research done. You know, when Donald Trump was the president, the amount of hatred I received went up by 2,000%. So there is a link between language used by politicians, people in positions of power and influence, and the impact it has, not just on me, but on Muslims or people who look like Muslims across the country. Women having their hijab torn off, young boys, because they look like Muslims, being verbally and racially abused, mosques having criminal damage done to them. And I think, look, one of the great things about London is, you know, you're free to be who you want to be. You're free to worship how you want to worship. And that sort of language doesn't make Muslims feel welcome. That should worry all of us, because I think, you know, if we're going to succeed in, you know, making sure, you know, that our diversity is a strength, our diversity is a sign of weakness, it makes us richer, not poorer, it makes us stronger, you know, not weaker, then we want politicians who represent us to understand that.
So one thing that you've said in the past is that there is a correlation between rising tension in the Middle East and a rise in anti-Semitism. Obviously, there's rising tension after October 7th and during the war in Gaza. Do you think that there has been a rise in anti-Semitism in this country?
Well, first things first, look, we'll talk shortly about October the 7th and what's happened since. There can be no excuse for anti-Semitism or Islamophobia. There can't be any excuse. You can't attribute the actions of what, you know, the IDF do or what Hamas do to Londoners because they happen to be Jewish or Muslim, and it's wrong. It should be called out. I think it's possible to be somebody who is pro-Palestinian, to be against the occupation for the last few decades, and to call out the actions of Hamas on October the 7th. I think similarly, it's possible to be somebody who's pro-Israel, passionately pro-Israel, and to call it the actions of IDF orchestrated by Netanyahu in Gaza since October. What I think is wrong and should be called out, you know, irrespective of people's background, is anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. It can't be right that, you know, people are scared to wear the Star of David. It can't be right that people are scared to wear the hijab. And I'd remind, you know, people in London and across the country and in the Western world, look, as tragic and heartbreaking, and we're going to talk about it shortly, as the events in Gaza are, you know, God willing, at some stage they will stop. And we've got to carry on being friends, neighbours and colleagues. And it makes it much harder when you see this increase in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And I'm afraid there's an increase in both of these things. There should be no hierarchy when it comes to racism or, you know, hatred. We should do with both things equally.
There has been criticism on you and your administration for failing to kind of address that rise in anti-Semitism in London in particular. The quote, you know, note that London has become a no-go zone for Jews, especially on weekends when there's marches, pro-Palestine marches. You know, we're speaking right now, there's a pro-Palestine march happening in the city as we speak. That comment comes from Robin Simcox, the government's commissioner for countering extremism. You are obviously campaigning, you're having conversations with British Jews, London Jews as well. Do you think that there is truth, there is weight to those words?
No, listen, I think there are some people who try and pit communities against one another, try and pit people against one another. I prefer to unite people and bring people together. So it's important to understand the context of what's happened over the last 6 months. I'm somebody who spent my entire professional life trying to encourage particularly minority communities, Muslims and others, to get involved in mainstream politics, to get involved in being active citizens living in a democracy. Now, being an active citizen isn't simply voting once every 4 or 5 years. It isn't just, you know, lobbying your MP or writing a letter. It's also protest. Protest is intrinsic to living in a democracy, right? Speak to those in North Korea or in Russia, they would give their left arm to have the right to protest. And actually, the reason why protest is important is, if you like, if you think about pressure cooker, it's a safety valve. It allows people to vent, express their feelings, and to put pressure, legitimate pressure, on people in positions of power and influence. It also sends a message of solidarity to those under siege in Gaza, whether it's in Rafah or elsewhere. But that protest should be lawful, peaceful, and safe. And so the police will, and I don't apologize for this, the police will take action if somebody breaks the law. That's why protest should be lawful, peaceful, and safe. And the vast majority of people who are protesting, hundreds of thousands in London every few weeks, have been protesting lawfully, peacefully, and safely. A very small minority have been, acting in a way that's not acceptable, and the police have taken action to suggest the whole of London, 600 miles squared, is a no-go area is simply not true. And I spend a lot of time every day speaking to Jewish friends, neighbours, and colleagues. They don't think London's a no-go area, but some Jewish people are frightened about coming into London on some days. They are anxious, and we should understand that and listen to that concern and anxiety. And so what I'd say to those protesting is, of course, protest, but just be conscious that sometimes you could be saying and doing stuff that may be lawful, but it's scaring people that shouldn't be scared. And so, you know, most of the protests, all the protests in terms of pro-Palestinian, have been coordinated with the police. They work very close together, the protesters and the police. They agree the time of day to start the protest. So the protests start after the Sabbath service, the Shabbat service. One protest was delayed by agreement with the protesters to allow bar mitzvah to finish, because what the protesters didn't want to do is cause anxiety to those people celebrating the bar mitzvah. So, you know, all I'd say in respectful ways, if people, look at this, in a way that's, dispassionate, people are taking advantage of the democratic rights. The vast, vast majority are behaving themselves, not breaking the law. A small minority, actions being taken against them. But what you wouldn't want to do, surely, is live in a country where protest is banned. A politician could decide which protests take place and which doesn't. Just imagine the consequence of that. It means a politician could say, this protest is allowed because I like the issue. This protest isn't allowed because I don't like the issue. What's next? Telling the police who to arrest. Telling the police who to charge. What's next? Telling the judge who to find guilty. So I think, living in a democracy, there is a tension sometimes. That's why we have a separation of powers. What we've got to make sure we do, though, is don't let anybody feel that they can't, they're not welcome into London. And that's why we'll take action against anybody who breaks the law.
It's been almost 6 months now since October 7th and since the beginning of the war in Gaza, which, by the United Nations estimates is, this is a group of people that are on the brink of famine. How do you understand, how do you feel about what's happening there right now?
Well, there's a reason why I called for a ceasefire back in October. Because it was clear to anybody watching, not just the images coming out of Gaza, but listening to all the groups working there. These are independent groups, by the way, not Muslim faith. The groups working there on the ground. Look at what the United Nations were saying, that there needed to be an immediate ceasefire back in October. There hasn't been. We're now talking almost 6 months on. 33,000 people, it's probably higher by the time this goes out, have lost their lives. A third or more are children. There are trucks containing food, containing medicine, containing aid that can't get into Gaza. What the United Nations has said just this week is, starvation should not be used as a weapon of war, right? We're not talking about a situation that is a consequence of a natural disaster. This is a man-made catastrophe. I think it's possible to condemn, and I do condemn the actions of Hamas. I want those 134 hostages to be released. But for goodness sake, this is madness. 33,000 people have died. and many more are going to perish over the course of the next few days and weeks. Every day you wake up to images of more people dying. This is not an issue that's an issue because, you know, it's a Muslim issue or a Palestinian issue or an Arab issue. It's an issue of humanity. I think it's really important for that, you know, ceasefire to happen, for food, aid and medicine to get in. And we know, listen, one of the reasons why Netanyahu wants this war to go on longer is it's self-preservation for him. How many men, women and children are going to die because of his career? Mm. And, you know, we need to make sure that we continue to exert pressure on President Biden, Prime Minister Sunak, because Rishi Sunak and Joe Biden are the two closest allies to Netanyahu. This has not been anti-Israel. This has been anti-Netanyahu and anti-killing and anti-death.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur for Palestine, Francesca Albanese, just in the last couple of days came out and said that Israel's actions in Gaza amount to genocide. There is obviously a case before the ICJ that was brought forward by South Africa that describes Israel's actions as genocide. Would you describe Israel's actions as genocide?
Well, I'm quite careful, not just as a former lawyer, but somebody who's the mayor of London. What the International Court of Justice said is plausible genocide in the interim judgment. And we've got to wait for the final judgment. But I applaud South Africa for bringing the case. And don't remember, in my lifetime, South Africa was an apartheid nation. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've met many South Africans in London who are incredibly proud that their country is now moving these sorts of cases in the ICJ, bearing in mind their awful history in my own lifetime. So let's wait and see what the ICJ concludes in its final judgment. But I think the interim judgment should have been a wake-up call for those who you know, are close to Netanyahu, to put pressure on him to realise the, you know, people are dying every day. What benefit, you know, is it bringing to you in the medium to long term? In the short term, yes, yeah, keeping you in your job. But in the medium to long term, what benefit is it bringing to either Israel or the occupied territories? But, you know, there are widows being created. There are orphans being created. There are amputees being created. There are maimed people as a consequence being created. And we're going to have another generation of hatred, of animus. And a two-state solution is further away than it is now. And also, what people don't seem to realize is there are members of the Israeli government now dismissing the idea of a two-state solution, not being called out by, you know, the British government, and I think they should be called out.
Mm-hmm. You've criticised Rishi Sunak and his handling of the situation. How do you feel about the way that the Labour Party has handled it? How do you feel about the way that Sir Keir Starmer, who's come under a lot of criticism for his what people perceive as kind of blanket pro-Israeli comments. Back in October, there were, you know, you broke away from him when you called for a ceasefire. He did it for several months. He also, you know, was commenting on an interview, I think it was an LBC interview, where he seemed to appear to condone what is collective punishment of people in Gaza. How do you feel that he's handled it? Do you think it's been any better than Rishi Sunak?
Look, what I'd remind your listeners, you know, those watching this, is, you know, the Labour Party isn't the party in government. The Labour Party is not in government. When I was in government, Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister. It's the party of government that's in the cockpit. And Gordon Brown called for a ceasefire in 2009 when the IDF in Israel attacked Gaza. Didn't have an impact. So Gordon jumped on a plane, went to the United Nations, at the UN Security Council, put out a motion for a ceasefire. The US abstained. But once that ceasefire motion was passed by the Security Council, within a week, there was a ceasefire in Gaza. The IDF pulled out. Mm-hmm. So what the United Nations says does matter. It's unfortunate there isn't a Labour government. I think, you know, criticism of, you know, Keir Starmer as Prime Minister would be legitimate and we could have that conversation. But he's in opposition. And so, yeah, of course, you know, on this issue, we may disagree. But, you know, he wants a two-state solution. He's criticised the actions of Israel. He's called for proportionate response from Netanyahu. He's been demanding access of food, aid and medicine, but he's an opposition politician. And a lot of attention, I understand, is focused on you know, politicians in parliament, but actually that allows the government off the hook. We've got to make sure the government is held to account for the way they've behaved in the last 6 months. And the point I make to my friends in America who are Democrats as well is, listen, you know, President Biden is the president. He's not the opposition leader, and we should be putting pressure on, you know, both President Biden and Prime Minister Sunak to take action.
You could argue that being in opposition grants you a lot more flexibility to be increasingly critical of the government and its position. And the criticism of Keir Starmer is that he hasn't been anywhere near enough critical of the British government's foreign policy towards Israel.
Well, listen, I heard this week both Keir Starmer and David Lammy criticising the Israeli government. I mean, listen, there'll be conversations about, you know, should, you know, they've called for a ceasefire sooner rather than later. You'll understand the argument there was in relation to the hostages. Look, people know where I stand on this issue.
Mm. And, you know, currently there's some of your peers in Labour that are calling for a ban to exports of British arms, you know, selling weapons to Israel. There's a petition that is being put forward by your colleague Zara Sultana. Is this something that you support?
Absolutely. I think the British government should be asking serious questions about what the weapons they export are used for. They should not be used in a way that, you know, there's even a question marks about international law being breached. Forget the ICJ interim judgment. There are things the British government can do and must do. And in the past, Labour governments have done so. A number of things at the disposal of the British government they could be doing to exert pressure on Netanyahu. I made the point earlier on that Rishi Sunak has, you know, boasted about his pride in his closeness to Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, the whole point about so-called special relationship is to use it. Where's the evidence of any pressure being exerted on Netanyahu to stop what he's doing?
Well, back in 2016, you know, when you were asked about your former positions on the BDS campaign, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and the call by Palestinian civil society for boycotts, economic boycotts, cultural boycotts against Israel as a tool of pressure, you said in 2016 that you no longer believed in boycotting Israel. Today, with everything that's happening, this is something that you still stand by.
Yeah. Look, when you have conversations with not just those in those Palestinians in and around the area, but also when you see who would suffer the consequence of the BDS, I'm not sure that, I don't think that's the right way forward, no.
Mm. Why is that?
Because what you're doing is you're punishing everyone in relation to, you know, BDS, whether it's boycotts, whether it's divestment, whether it's sanctions. It's not micro-targeted about what you want to achieve, but also the downside far outweighs the upside. So I understand why people feel passionately about this. You know, Israel is the only nation in the world that's you know, Jewish majority. So people are nervous about the impact it has on Jewish people as well as those, you know, Palestinians, many of them are Muslims, who work in the occupied territories. So, you know, people understandably are trying to think about levers they can, you know, pull in relation to putting pressure on Netanyahu. I think there are much more effective levers the British government has.
Well, you mentioned South Africa and apartheid in South Africa in particular, and boycotts and sanctions were key tools that were used to rally support for the ANC, for, you know, support against apartheid, which inevitably was successful in bringing down the apartheid system.
I don't know if you speak to historians in relation to de Klerk and Botha and others in relation, so I'm not sure that's factually right, but we can agree to disagree on that.
Okay, I mean, just in terms of, you know, those levers that you mentioned, what kind of levers exist for Palestinians?
The closest allies of Israel is the US and the UK, right? Those are the closest allies. The outliers are the UK and the US. Most other countries in the world, just look at the votes in the UN over the last 5.5 months. Russia and China for different reasons, but it's been UK and the US. Now the UK is starting to move a bit. You know, so is the US, and that pressure is really important, both the US government and the UK government. Why? Because Netanyahu needs the support of the US. We've seen in the last 48 hours apparent movement from Netanyahu in relation to ceasefire. We've got to hope that the pressure from President Biden is paying off, because that's what's needed, a ceasefire. And that ceasefire needs to be, you know, not just for 24 hours or 48 hours. It's got to be ceasefire that lasts, you know, for months and then years. Ceasefires that last for months and then years start with a day, then 2 days, then a week, then 2 weeks. And that's the pressure that's going to be exerted by the governments of the UK and the US, which are the two governments who are the closest to Netanyahu and Israel.
So you don't think boycotts are an effective form of anti-violent resistance?
In relation to what's happening in Gaza now, it will have no impact.
Mm. Okay. And in terms of what is happening in the Labour Party, there's been a lot of divisions internally over the Labour Party stance. There's also been a lot of spillout with Labour Party voters and voter base, particularly within Muslim communities. And we've seen in recent weeks, in recent months, a lot of organizing around independent candidates, You know, the Rochdale by-election was an example of that. And there would be a lot of people in London that are thinking about, do I want to support a Labour Party candidate? Do I want to support a Labour Party mayor? What do you say to them? And what do you, I mean, surely you're meeting a lot of Muslim constituents these days, especially during Ramadan, and a lot of them are angry, a lot of them are upset at the Labour Party. What's your response to them?
Well, the choice of the general election, I mean, obviously I'm in a different position to the Labour Party nationally, but the choice of the general election is not between Keir Starmer's Prime Minister or somebody with a perfect policy on Palestine. You know, the choice is Keir Starmer's Prime Minister or Rishi Sunak. That's the choice. That is it. There's only two choices. And how is Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister working for you? How's it working for you in relation to foreign policy? How's it worked for you in the last 6 months with Gaza? How's it worked for you in relation to your hospital? How's it worked for you in relation to your local school? How's it worked for you in relation to the cost of living crisis? How's it worked for you in relation to the last 14 years in austerity? And that's the choice. Or Keir Starmer, who's going to be a change Prime Minister, and, you know, the option of allowing best to be the enemy of perfect or best to be the enemy of good. And if you don't vote for, you know, the Labour Party in the general election, it's one less for the Conservatives to get. And the Conservatives work on the basis that the opposition is divided. The Conservative Party is the most successful political party in the Western democratic world. Why? Because they know how to win elections. They will sometimes change the rules to make it easier to win, as they've done with my election. They brought in photo ID, so everyone needs photo ID to vote now. Why have they done that? Because 900,000 Londoners haven't got photo ID. Poor Londoners, black, Asian, minority, ethnic Londoners, those who live in rented accommodation tend to vote for me. They've also brought in first past the post. So if you vote for Green first or Lib Dem first or Independent first, you can't vote for me second. You've got to vote for just one person. That's why they're successful. And those who are unhappy with the Conservatives, if they splinter, don't be surprised if you wake up a day after the general election with Rishi Sunak as the Prime Minister. How have the last five Conservatives worked out for you? Cameron, Johnson, May, Truss, and Sunak.
It's a tough argument to put forward to a voter, especially somebody who is feeling very heartbroken, moved by what's happening in Gaza, and is looking for a sense of leadership in their country, especially from their politicians. And if you talk to some of these organizers, you know, the Muslim Vote, for example, the organization that is trying to mobilize different voter bases, they'll say that there is a 4% constituency in this country that's Muslim. In London, it's about 10%, right? And they have traditionally almost, you know, assuredly voted Labour and have been taken for granted as a result. And now is an opportunity to show that the Muslim vote actually is something significant that should be paid attention to.
Well, let's deal with this. Muslims have been taken for granted. Which party allowed, for the first time ever, Muslim faith schools? Was it the Conservative Party? There were, for historically in this country, Christian faith schools, Jewish faith schools. What are Muslim faith schools? Who brought that in? It was the Labour Party. Which party brought in laws to protect discrimination against the followers of Islam? It was the Labour Party. Which party has supported those parts of our country which are the poorest, most deprived, where most Muslims live? It's the Labour Party. Which party cancelled debt of the poorest country in the world, Muslim-majority countries? The Labour Party. Which party in government did more trade with the poorest country in the world, who are Muslim countries? The Labour Party. Which party had the first ever MP of Islamic faith? The Labour Party. Which MP had the first member of the House of Lords of Islamic faith? The Labour Party. Which party the first ever member attending cabinet who was a Muslim? The Labour Party. Which party had a candidate who stood to be mayor of London and won the election in the most anti-Islamic, in the most Islamophobic, racist campaign in history? The Labour Party. So look, we can talk about, you know, the imperfections of the Labour Party. My point being is no party is perfect, and the choice in the mayoral election is me or the person you mentioned who said things clearly Islamophobic. That's the choice in the mayoral election. Only one of us is going to win. So do you want to wake up on May the 3rd with her as the mayor? And the choice in the general election is do you want the same old with the Conservative government? Because that's a choice. Mm. With respect, the choice isn't George Galloway as Prime Minister or Sunak. It's Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak. And, you know, one of the things I've sought to do as a politician my entire life is in a respectful, non-patronising way to embark on political education. We've got to encourage people to join political parties, get involved in mainstream politics. That's why I feel so strongly we shouldn't be banning protests, because that's how we become active citizens, right? And by the way, it's legitimate and right and proper for the people you're mentioning to hold politicians to account. That's the joy of a democracy, right? Being held to account. Me doing a long interview, being asked challenging questions. That's the joy of a democracy. Yeah. And that's how it should be. Mm. And people should be angry about what's happening in Gaza. We've entered the last 10 days of Ramadan, the last 10 nights of Ramadan. It also happens to coincidentally to be, you know, Easter weekend. That is holy land, according to the Christians, right? And so people are right to be angry. You can't wake up and watch those images and not either cry and weep or be angry. And, you know, we got to call out our politicians, you know, but the idea that we have, a more stringent test on Labour when we're in opposition for the last 14 years than we do in the party of government, I think is a bit naive and a bit wrong.
We are in we're months ahead of an election, a general election, and that could put Sir Keir Starmer into the position of Prime Minister. And a lot of people are watching the things that he says publicly, the things that he says on Israel, the things that he says on Gaza, as indications of what kind of Prime Minister he's going to be.
The NHS and education and jobs and the economy and growth and equalities laws and employment laws, all those things as well.
Yeah. And there's also a separate conversation about individual MPs and individual electoral seats. And some of the organizing that is happening is around individuals and looking at, you know, seats. And,
sure.
and so,
sure,
I mean,
sure,
one
sure.
of the people, you know, Roshanar Ali, for example, as somebody that abstained from the vote against a ceasefire. And there are British Muslims that say this is something that means enough to me that I am willing to let it decide who I vote for come the general election. It's hard to dismiss somebody when they tell that to you.
No, of course, you must never dismiss what voters say. And they are saying that. And people are hurt. I've met, but that isn't. Of course, we've all met people who are upset and angry and hurt. I've lost count of the number of Londoners I've met who've lost loved ones, in that part of the world in the last 6 months. It's heartbreaking. People have to decide if the election, the general election, is a referendum on how perfect or imperfect party was, but you know that there are only two parties that can win the election, the Conservatives or Labour. And so, you know, all I'd say in a respectful way, because of course I respect people's feelings, and you know, people are genuinely and rightly, and that's a good thing, that shows you've got a heart, upset about what's happening in Gaza. But be careful what you wish for, because it's happened before, when you know people have allowed best to be the enemy of perfect, and that would mean the Conservatives are in power for another 5 years. And I think that'd be awful, not just for the people in Gaza, but awful for this country as well, and across the globe, where we know in the past, Labour governments have done a huge amount of good in parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, parts of the Middle East, in the Balkans, and so forth. And that's why it's important for people to realise we have 14 years of this, right? Keir Starmer has not been the Prime Minister for 14 years. Mm. No Labour politician has. The last Labour Prime Minister there was Gordon Brown, and look at the good that he did.
Do you have faith in Keir Starmer to lead effectively in foreign policy?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
And how do you think this country should be positioning itself with regards to Israel?
Well, look, I think the position of the Labour governments in the past has been one where they're calling for a two-state solution. They're quite clear in relation to there shouldn't be advantage taken of those in the West Bank or in Gaza. It's really important. Those who are, occupying Palestinian land shouldn't occupy the land. It's really important for there to be a viable Palestinian state. It's really important to use all the levers the British government has at its disposal. The British government is a permanent member of the UN Security Council. That provides a huge amount of influence. The Labour government, Gordon Brown's government, the one that I was a member of, did a huge amount towards a two-state solution. But at the end of the day, we need the Americans to pull their weight as well, because they're the closest ally to Israel, and it's really important that the US government is influenced to do much more in this area, because we know the importance of the US to Netanyahu. That's why it's really important that those of our friends in the United States use their influence to put pressure on. There's also big elections this year in America, right? There's big elections in India, Indonesia, this country, and America, and half the world's population is voting this year.
Yeah.
Netanyahu would have been gone a long time ago, but for what's happening in Gaza.
Mm. We're speaking a couple of weeks away from your own key election. How confident do you feel about your chances?
So this is the toughest election that I've fought. Why do I say that? Because the government's changed the voting system to make it much harder for me to win this time. What they've done is they've done two things which make it more difficult. One is, in the past, what happened was people would vote for a smaller party first. You could vote two votes, one and a two. They'd vote for a smaller party, number one, and vote for me, number two, like an insurance policy. And the government realized I want a big amount of the second preferences from the smaller party. So they've now removed that chance. You only get one vote, one cross. And the second thing they've done is brought in photo ID. 15% of Londoners who are eligible to vote haven't got photo ID. You're allowed to have a passport, a driving license, or an older person's travel card, not a younger person's travel card. Mm. Why? Because younger people vote for me. Older people may not. It's going to be really tough. So don't think, and people say to me on the doorstep, I've been out campaigning today, oh, you're definitely going to win. You know, what are you worried about? Don't be complacent. Don't think, oh, Sadiq's definitely going to win. He doesn't need my support, number one. Number two, this is a two-horse race. Only one of us is going to be the mayor. The Conservative candidate, you've mentioned a bit about her, or me. And that's why I'm asking people who live in London to give me their vote on May the 2nd. Remember, you've got a photo ID to vote. Don't go to the polling station and be turned away because of lack of voter ID. But it's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. I'm under no illusions. I've worked incredibly hard over the last 8 years. I'm going to carry on working up until 10 p.m. on May the 2nd to try and remind Londoners of what we've achieved over the last 8 years. You will know my stance in relation to what's happened since October the 7th. It's really important for people to understand that, the choice is, a future London that's, fairer, safer and greener, or it's going backwards with the Conservatives.
And finally, what is your vision for a future London? What is your vision for your third term?
Well, we're having this conversation. People may not realise this, but, we've had a number of different events taking place just in the last few days and weeks in London. We had Holi, the Hindu community celebrated. We've had Easter, this weekend. Next week is Vaisakhi, the Sikh community celebrates. We're in the month of Ramadan. Very soon we're going to have St. George's Day, really important to the English. Just a few weeks ago, I celebrated St. Patrick's Day with my Irish friends. That's the joy of London, how diversity is a strength, not a weakness. At the same time, if I'm re-elected, I'll have the opportunity to build many tens of thousands more homes. As it is, we've built more council homes than any time since the 1970s. We can do much more with the Labour government, 40,000 council homes and many more with the Labour government. More investment in youth clubs, more investment in the police, keeping fares down, importantly investing in young people so they can flourish and thrive, which is really, really important. And the key thing for me is this. We will have the chance for the first time in 8 years since I've been mayor, but the first time since 2004 to have a Labour government and a Labour mayor working together. And that is so exciting because we can bring about real meaningful change, a fairer, safer, greener London.
Sadiq Khan, it's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for watching this episode of The Big Picture, and a big thank you to Mayor Sadiq Khan for being our guest today. We want to hear your thoughts, so please leave them in the comments below and let us know who you'd like us to speak to next. As always, you can listen to this episode wherever you get your podcasts from, and until next time, salam.